And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. According to the famed film director Francis Ford Coppola, the very earliest people who made film were magicians. Our guest today, film critic Kenneth Turan, discovered the cinematic magic of Hollywood's past while watching television as a kid via Million Dollar Movie, New York City's weekly showcase of classic films, and Million Dollar Movie aired in other cities as well. Those old movies in black and white fired Kenneth Turan's interest in movies and led him to become one of the nation's leading authorities on motion pictures. As the film critic for the Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition. Kenneth Turan's new book is not to be missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. This is a decade-by-decade list of the movies that have meant the most to him. He's quick to make clear that this is not a compilation, it's not a definitive best-of list, but a very personal accounting. It begins with Fantomas, the 1913 French horror film of the silent era, and goes up to the present decade, providing historical context, amusing trivia, and personal anecdotes throughout. And today we'll hear about some of his favorites and why they have importance to a man who's lived a lifetime, devoted a whole career to reviewing films. And I want to say it's a great pleasure to have Kenneth Turan on here. Many of our listeners on WYPR know him from his reviews on NPR. Kenneth Turan, welcome to Midday on WYPR.
It's great to be here.
And we're joined today, Kenneth Turan, by Christopher Llewellyn Reed. Chris Reed is chair of the film and video department at Stevenson University, right outside of Baltimore, and he joins us each month for Midday on Film. So, Chris, it's nice to have you with us, and say hello to Kenneth Turan.
Great to be here, Dan. And Kenneth Turan, I'm a big fan of yours, listen to you all the time. It's wonderful to be on air with you.
Thank you.
How many years has it been for you on NPR, Kenneth?
Gosh, I'm afraid to count. it's been a few.
Okay. Well, let me start with this question, because it's not a best-of list. It's not a movies you need to see kind of thing. It doesn't have that kind of urging tone to it. So how did you set out to do it? What were the parameters that you set for yourself in this book?
Well, you know, we all have our favorites, you know, and these were the ones that really meant the most to me, the ones that I could see again and again and again. And, you know, in some ways, there's a messianic thing in this for me. You know, I became a film critic really to help people find films that they like and tell them more about films that they already think they know something about. So that was the urge here, to let people know about some of these wonderful films.
I mentioned the Francis Ford Coppola quote. This other quote that you use in the book from Ingmar Bergman, no form of art goes beyond ordinary consciousness as film does, straight to our emotions, deep into the twilight room of the soul. Oh, wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That's a great quote.
Well, you know, I mean, people feel films very, very deeply. I mean, I get, as you can imagine, a lot of hostile response to some of my reviews. And I really kind of take that as kind of confirmation of the fact that people care so much about film. If you don't like what they like, they are so upset. They care so much. And that's a wonderful thing.
I couldn't agree more, Kenneth. And I actually have the problem that I care and feel so deeply. And as I get older, I find myself identifying with the characters more and more. So when I'm watching something like, let's go to TV for a sec, the TV series Breaking Bad, I get really uncomfortable because I'm identifying with Walter White and he's doing horrible things.
Right.
And I find myself sometimes paranoid that someone's coming to get me. And this happens all the time in thrillers too, or the great film noirs of the 40s. I invest myself so much in the action.
Yeah. You know, he mentioned Million Dollar Movie. And I grew up in the Boston area watching Boston television, all three channels. You have to tell kids, you do have to remind kids or tell them, inform them. That, right, Kenneth? You only at one point there was only three channels on, and there was that Million Dollar Movie. I think Boston had it too. I'm thinking it was Saturday afternoon maybe, or Saturday evening. I can't remember. When was Million Dollar Movie on in New York?
In New York, it was on a couple of nights a week, I think seven, maybe even every night of the week. Yeah. But they, you know, it was WOR. It was an independent channel. It was a smaller channel. And, you know, they had these old Hollywood films. And my parents, you know, they were in parental controls in those days. If it was on TV, my parents thought it was fine for me to watch. So I watched a lot of old movies, and I really fell in love with them.
Yeah, me too. And Westerns maybe on Saturday afternoons. That may be what I'm thinking of. But that's our first exposure to the movies, other than the going to the theater to see first-run films.
Yeah. No, those were really great. I mean, I saw Hopalong Cassidy, who I'm still a fan of. Hoppy, you know, I was exposed to him on my little tiny TV. I mean, even though now I'm a big partisan of the theatrical experience, and I did go to the movies sometimes, but most of my movie watching was on TV.
For me, what encapsulates the sort of magic of movie going was when my mother rented a 16-millimeter projector from the library and a 16-millimeter print of High Noon for a birthday party when I was about 9, 10
really?
Years old.
Holy cow, that must have been great.
It was fantastic, and it's probably one of the main reasons why I've been such a movie fan, movie historian, and even a filmmaker now.
That's
is because
so funny.
Of that experience.
Did she have a screen, a movie screen to show
we,
it on?
We rented the screen.
Wow. From the library?
From the library.
Yeah, we didn't have a screen, so my father had this projector, and he showed it on the side of the refrigerator. So we watched, like Disney shorts. I don't know where he got it. I don't know where he got this stuff. I can't even remember now, but we didn't have a screen, so we watched it. It was on the side of the refrigerator in the kitchen. That's where we watched it. Hey,
wow.
Kenneth Turan, you go back to the silent era here as you chronicle or account for your favorite films. So we can't air any a clip from a silent movie, obviously, on the radio. But I wish you'd talk about, I've always pronounced it Fantomas, maybe Fantoma. Let's talk about that one.
If I say Fantomas, I think Fantomas. That's what I've usually heard.
Okay.
This was one of the, you know, this is from 1913. This is the earliest film in the book. Fantomas was one of the great arch criminals, a person who was like more exciting than the hero. This is one of the earliest of these people, the scourge of Paris. And there's some imagery, even though these films are very early, they're primitive in some ways, but there's some imagery in this film that I remember the first time I saw it. It just takes your breath away. There's some moments of astonishing filmmaking here and just a phenomenal character. You know, the man they couldn't catch, the villain of all villains, Fantomas.
Fantomas.
And it kind of paves the way for all later films where we end up identifying with the villain because he is more interesting, or even into films. You know, later 80s blockbusters like Die Hard, where the villain, we may not be meant to identify with him, but he's certainly in some ways more interesting than the main character.
And you had
absolutely.
Kenneth, you had some other silent films in that era.
Yeah, I mean, there's some silent comedies that I couldn't resist. I'm a big Buster Keaton fan, Sherlock Jr., which I think is just, you know, one of the most visually amazing films kind of I've ever seen. And then there's a man who's much less well-known these days, a man named Max Davidson. Did a short called Pass the Gravy, just a very funny film. Someone who was very popular back in the day, who's just about unknown today. But again, I'd like to bring him to people's attention.
Can I jump to the 1930s, because that's a rich period. I want to spend some time with you on that one, and Chris Reed will take your comments too. We get to this name, Leo McCarey. Leo McCarey films would have been some of the films that you saw on Million Dollar Movie on TV, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, he's one of the few directors in the book that I have two films from. One of them is Love Affair, which is... really just a heartwarming, heartbreaking love story. It inspired a lot of later films. But the one I really, you know, think is really an extraordinary film is Make Way for Tomorrow. You watch this film, you can't believe what you're seeing. It's a film made in the 1930s, and it's about the difficulties. You know, there's a famous Yiddish phrase, you know, one mother can raise 10 children, but 10 children can't take care of one mother. You know, it's about parents getting elderly and their relationship with their adult children and what happens when they get too old to live on their own. It really deals with these issues that we think Hollywood never dealt with. It's very honest. It's very moving. It really is a remarkable, remarkable film.
I'm glad you said that. We think Hollywood didn't deal with those issues in the 1930s. And as we found out here from Midday on Film with Linda DeLibero and Chris Reed, yeah, they did.
And in fact, I would include from the same era a film similarly dealing with issues we didn't think Hollywood dealt with, The Awful Truth, Cary Grant and Irene Dunne, which is one of, and I believe that's also McCarey, although I may be mistaken.
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, and that is one of my favorite films. It's a comedy of divorce. And it's very sexy in a way that we didn't think films of that time, at least looking backwards now, could be.
We have a clip from Kenneth Turan's film list in the 1930s. This is I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. This is 1932. Kenneth, would you just talk a little bit about this, and then we'll set up the clip. The clip is simply a final scene of the movie. It's Paul Muni and Glenda Farrell. But talk a little bit about this one.
Yeah, this is one of the films I saw in Million Dollar Movie. And, you know, even though it probably was, I don't know, 55 years ago that I saw this clip, saw this entire film, I can remember so vividly how I felt when I saw this ending. I mean, I had just seen kind of normal Hollywood films. And this was what I found out later was a pre-code film where they really dealt with issues in a way that Hollywood didn't after that. This is, as you'll hear, this is an extremely despairing ending. This is a kind of apocalyptic ending. I didn't think that was legal. I didn't think Hollywood films could do this. You know, I said, are they going to arrest these people? You know, as a kid, I was just flabbergasted to see a film end this way. And, you know, I should say a little bit about the story. Paul Muni
Okay,
played,
just
played
before them. We get... Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, but, yeah, Paul Muni plays kind of a returning World War I veteran who gets into trouble, not really his own fault, and ends up kind of put on a chain gang. And he always remains this honest, upstanding guy, tries to do the right thing. He escapes because things are hopeless, tries to rebuild his life. But through it all, he remains just a pillar of rectitude, at least for most of the film.
Jim, why haven't you come before?
I couldn't. I was afraid to.
But you could have written. It's been almost a year since you escaped.
But I haven't escaped. They're still after me. They'll always be after me. I've had jobs, but I can't keep them. Something happens. Someone turns up. I hide in rooms all day and travel by night. No friends, no rest, no peace.
Oh, Jim.
Keep moving. That's all that's left for me. Forgive me, Helen. I had to take a chance to see you tonight. Just to say goodbye.
Oh, Jim. It was all going to be so different.
It is different. They've made it different.
I can't let you go like this. Can't you tell me where you're going? Will you write? Do you need any money? But you must, Jim. How do you live?
I steal.
What's happening there, Kenneth?
Wow. I mean, I can feel the hair on the back of my head.
Yeah, even without seeing it, I can...
Rising, yeah. Even without seeing it. Well, you know, this is this completely honest person who society, in its quote-unquote wisdom, has turned into a thief, you know. That's how does he live? He steals. And then you hear the footsteps, he flees into the darkness, and the film is over. That is the end. And wow, is that a flabbergasting way to end.
Is that Fade to Black... we heard something about the way that movie ended in the direction of it, that there actually was sort of an accident the way it faded into darkness. Did you?
Yeah, I mean, I've read that the director said like a light went out or something, you know, a fuse blew. I don't know. You know, I mean, sometimes people like to kind of spin tales. Even though that's the director's story, I'm not convinced that it's true. He might have thought it was a good story that he liked to tell.
Let's go to 1940. And we have another film I'd like to talk about, and we can listen to a clip from. This is The Shop Around the Corner, Jimmy Stewart. And folks will know the story of this, right, Chris Reed, from You've Got Mail?
Yes,
am
they
I right?
Will.
Tom Hanks and...
Although I do not recommend watching You've Got Mail instead of The Shop Around the Corner.
Okay. I know you like this movie, too.
I love Ernst Lubitsch, so really anything he made is something worth watching. And this is really a fantastic romantic comedy from 1940.
But Kenneth Ryan, tell us why this made your list, and tell us a little bit about the movie as we set up the clip.
Well, I can watch all the films in this book are films I can watch again and again and again. This is basically my desert island collection, the films I would take with me if I were exiled someplace, you know, Elba or something, you know. And, you know, it takes place in a, you know, actually, you know, unnamed Middle European city, as many of Lubitsch's films do. And it's about the two co-workers in a shop in, you know, who were played by Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan, who really can't stand each other, but, you know, turn out to have something in common and that they don't find out till the end of the film.
Tell me, who is the girl?
Oh, you know that girl I was corresponding with?
Oh, yes, about the cultural subjects.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, after a while, we got on the subject of love. Naturally, on a very cultural level.
Well, what else can you do in a letter?
She is the most wonderful girl in the world.
Is she pretty?
She has such ideals and such a viewpoint on things that she's so far above all the girls you meet today, there's just no comparison.
So she's not so very pretty.
Well, don't say that.
I'm sorry. Main thing is that you like her.
Hope I will.
What do you mean? You love a girl and you don't know if you like her?
Well, it's just the question. Haven't met her yet.
Why? You haven't met her yet?
No. I keep postponing it and postponing it. I'm scared. You see, this girl thinks I'm the most wonderful person in the world, and after all, the chance she might be disappointed.
Yes, there's a chance.
Yeah, on the other hand...
You might be disappointed, too.
And don't dare think about it. Paravich, did you ever get a bonus?
Yes, once.
Yeah. You know, the boss hands you the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
You wonder how much is in it. You don't want to open it. As long as the envelope's closed, you're a millionaire. You keep postponing that moment, and you can't postpone it forever. I'm meeting her tonight, 8:30 in a cafe.
That Carnation?
Yeah. Yeah. She's using one for a bookmark and a copy of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. I'm wearing one in my lapel. Haven't slept for days.
I'm sure she'll be beautiful.
Well, not too beautiful. No. What chance is a fellow like me?
What do you want? A homely girl?
No. Now, you knock on wood for me. Just a lovely, average girl. That's all I want.
The Shop Around the Corner, 1940, James Stewart, Jimmy Stewart. In your book, Kenneth Turan, you refer to the Lubitsch touch, a cinematic mix of sorrow, humor, emotion, and sophistication.
Yeah, and you can hear it in that clip. I mean, this whole section, the whole film is so intricately constructed. It's like a real elaborate piece of clockwork that works beautifully. And Jimmy Stewart was so good for a role like this. You know, I mean, obviously he's a sophisticated actor, but he's so good at kind of being this kind of aw shucks personality, mm-hmm. this kind of regular guy. He just does it beautifully.
Kenneth Turan with us. Chris Reed, one last comment about that film?
I just wanted to say that you talk about the Lubitsch touch, and of course the great writer-director Billy Wilder, who also has a film in your book, Sunset Boulevard, he was a sort of disciple of Ernst Lubitsch and would always ask himself when he was making his own films, what would Lubitsch do?
Chris, I think he even had that as a sign in his office.
I've heard that, yes, indeed.
Chris Reed with us, and we're joined by Kenneth Turan, whose book is not to be missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. And we'll hear more from Kenneth Turan when we get back and hear some more clips from his favorite movies. And then later in the hour, Chris Reed and I will be talking about Eli Wallach, who died yesterday. So this is Midday on Film, a special edition with Kenneth Turan and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. We'll be right back. 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. Casablanca is in the 1940s, too, so I'm going to ask you about that. Now, that's the one film I think probably is on a lot of top 10 lists or favorite movie of all time. I think that comes up. People will mention Casablanca. So, our listeners won't be surprised to hear that that's on your list, Kenneth Turan, but I want to hear you say why.
Well, you know, I almost didn't put Casablanca in the book. I had the same feeling that you described. Well, everyone knows Casablanca. What new is there to say about it? And then I happened to be watching a documentary. A British film critic is doing a piece on, you know, kind of the history of the film and the films that he loved. And he started the series by putting down Casablanca, saying, you know, this is so old hat, this is corny. And so I said, well, I'll give it another shot. I'll put it on the DVD player, watch it again. And, you know, I fell in love with it all over again. I said, this is just a marvelous film. It just has to be in the book. So there it is.
There is nothing to put down about Casablanca. It is pure cinematic marvel.
It's like a perfect film.
Almost. In many ways, yeah. Yes.
Okay. A year earlier, 1941, is it The Lady Eve or Lady Eve? Yeah, it's The Lady Eve.
The Lady Eve,
and
yeah.
This is a Preston Sturges film that we discussed on Midday on Film when we devoted an hour appreciation of Preston Sturges movies. And Chris Reed recommended to our listeners that they see this film if they hadn't. It made your list. Tell us why, Kenneth Turan.
Well, this is Preston Sturges is just a comic genius. There's no other way to put it. He made a series of films that are just really, as a group, I think the funniest films an American ever made. The wit, the verbal dexterity, the kind of elegant slapstick that he put his characters through, it just never ceases to make me laugh and laugh and laugh. There's a scene in the beginning of the film. Henry Fonda plays a wealthy heir to a fortune who's in love with snakes, and he's been in the Amazon for, you know, a long period of time, and he comes on this boat and he runs into Barbara Stanwyck, who is very glamorous and a con woman to boot, and their interaction in her stateroom is just brilliant.
Is this the scene we have? This is a flirting scene between the two, Henry Fonda and Barbara Stanwyck. So why don't we listen to this, and then we'll get Chris Reed's comments.
What were you doing up the Amazon?
Looking for snakes. I'm an ophiologist.
I thought you were in the beer business.
Beer? Ale?
What's the difference?
Between beer and ale?
Yes.
My father burst a blood vessel if he heard you say that. There's a big difference. Ale's sort of fermented on the top or something, and beer's fermented on the bottom, or maybe it's the other way around. There's no similarity at all. See, the trouble with being descended from a brewer, no matter how long ago he brewed it, or whatever you call it, you're supposed to know all about something you don't give a hoot about.
Chris.
Oh, I love this film. I love most Preston Sturges, but it's really the interplay between Barbara Stanwyck, and we did a show on her recently,
yeah,
and Henry Fonda, who, yeah, most people don't think as having a light comedic touch that really, really helps Sturges' dialogue come alive. They're just wonderful together in the film.
Kenneth Turan, also from the 1940s, you mentioned Strawberry Blonde, a film I have not seen. Could you tell us why that's on your list?
Yeah, this is a bit of an unusual choice. I mean, this film, I mean, it's even hard to describe. It's a James Cagney, kind of an offbeat role for him. I'm a big James Cagney fan. I almost put White Heat on. I almost put Yankee Doodle Dandy on. But I came back to Strawberry Blonde because it's very satisfying in a very kind of human level. It's about a man coming to terms with his life and coming to terms with an old anger and an old fury and understanding that his life is better than he thought it had been. It's a very wise film, even though it's done in a very low-key way. It's not on everyone's list, but again, it means a lot to me, this film.
What's the film? I'm drawing a blank on this. Henry Fonda, James Cagney, Jack Lemmon, they're on board a ship in World War II.
Mr. Roberts.
Yeah.
Mr. Roberts, yeah.
I really like that movie. I like Cagney. I'm a sucker for James Cagney, too.
Oh, yeah, so, he's great. Yeah. I can still see him, you know, dancing down the stairs at the end of Yankee Doodle Dandy, another favorite of mine. Right. You know, just a great, great screen actor.
Now, so The Lady Eve, and now we'll move to All About Eve, 1950, Joseph Mankiewicz film. This is a movie my older brother Joe introduced me to, and I'm so glad he did. I had no awareness of it until he said, hey, you ought to see All About Eve. What a cast, what a ensemble in this film. But go ahead, Kenneth Turan.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, Joseph L. Mankiewicz was one of the great writer-directors. This is a great screenplay, and also he created great characters. This is probably the iconic Bette Davis part. She plays a theatrical diva who kind of, takes a viper into her nest, and, you know, it's just a fascinating story about the theater, about rivalry, about character, about love. You know, as many of these great films do, it just encompasses a big swath of life. I mean, that's why I think people will love these films.
Yeah, great screenplay.
It has great depth of acting, too. I mean, beyond Bette Davis, we've got George Saunders, we have Anne Baxter, and we have even Marilyn Monroe in a bit part.
That's right. Yeah. And Celeste Holm.
Let's not forget Celeste Holm.
Yeah. That's 1950. 1952, I'm glad to see this on your list, Kenneth Turan, Singing in the Rain.
Oh, you have to love Singing in the Rain. You know, I mean, this is, to me, the best of the Hollywood musicals. It's the epitome of this group called the Freed Unit that made musicals for MGM. It's marvelous. This is a film that really words fail me. You just have to sit there and watch it. It just unfolds in front of you, the music, the comedy, the relationships. It's just a treat. And it's a film about Hollywood. I really enjoy Hollywood movies about Hollywood, and this is one of the ones. It's one of the most fun.
Now, the clip, I'm not familiar with this scene. I can't remember it. But anyway, folks might be expecting to hear the voice of Gene Kelly or Donald O'Connor, and Kenneth Turan just mentioned Debbie Reynolds. But this is a scene. This is Roscoe Dexter coaching Lena Lamont. So this is Douglas Fowley coaching Gene Hagen. This is a sound recording scene, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do we need any more setup for that, or can we just?
Well, you know, the picture is about the transition between silent film to sound film. So
right.
A lot of people who were big stars, they had to take elocution lessons, and this is Lena Lamont's elocution lesson.
All right, here we go. Quiet.
Quiet.
Roland.
got to talk into the mic. I can't pick it up.
Cut! What's the matter, Dexter?
It's Lena. Look, Lena, don't you remember I told you? There's a microphone right there in the bush.
Yeah.
You have to talk into it.
I was talking, wasn't I, Miss Dinsmore?
Yes, my dear, but please remember round tones. Pierre, you shouldn't have come.
Pierre, you shouldn't have come.
Yes, yes, my dear, that's much better now.
Hold it a second. Alina, look, here's the mic, right here in the bush.
Yeah.
Now you talk towards it. The sound goes through the cable to the box. A man records it on a big record in wax. But you have to talk into the mic first. In the bush. I'll try it again.
Jesus is dumb.
Jean Hagen is just a marvel in this film. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. Unfortunately, didn't win, but she's fantastic. And the film holds up. I use it in classes. And the 20-somethings today still really enjoy it.
Christopher, I want to tell our listeners, this is Chris Reed from Stevenson University joining us on Midday Today, and Kenneth Turan, his book, Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. Kenneth, go right ahead, sorry. No, Gene Hagen appears in another film on my list in a completely different role. You almost can't believe it's the same actress. She plays the kind of the sad girlfriend of Sterling Hayden in The Asphalt Jungle. It's a completely different performance, and it shows her remarkable range. I'm going to push up to the 1960s now, I think. Yes, because I want to talk about The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. I really like this film as well. Kenneth Turan, please tell us why it's on your list. Oh, gosh. This is, I'm a big Western fan. I think there are at least three Westerns in the book. And this is kind of a sad Western, almost an anti-Western in some ways. It tells us, that we can't really trust what we think is the truth. It uses some of the biggest stars of the day, Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne, and Lee Marvin. And it's a story about, kind of how the West was won, in quotes, but kind of the price we paid for that. And there are parts of this film that make me tear up because there's so much emotion involved in the telling of the story.
In many ways, it's a film about Hollywood's mythologizing of the Old West, because it's about, when legend becomes more important than fact. Print the legend, I think, is the final line, or one of the final lines. And it's really about how we choose to see our own history. It is, next to My Darling Clementine, my favorite John Ford film.
Thank you, Chris Reed. We have a clip from this. This is Carlton Young Maxwell ripping up Jimmy Stewart, the character Jimmy Stewart plays, Ransom's story, and throws it in the furnace before delivering a potent message about the West. Can you help us a little bit more with that one, Kenneth Turan, before we listen? Gosh, that's probably a newspaper office. Yeah. And, it's just, I'd have to hear it again to be sure exactly what was going on. But, I mean, there's a lot of stock characters here. There's the alcoholic newspaper editor, who's one of the characters in this scene. But it's interesting that John Ford, who made a ton of these mythologizing Westerns, really decided to kind of take a step back and really acknowledge the mythologizing here. Okay. That's sort of to Chris Reed's point. Let's listen in.
Well, you know the rest of it. I went to Washington, we won statehood, I became the first governor.
3 terms as governor, 2 terms in the Senate, ambassador to the court of St. James, back again to the Senate, and a man who, with a snap of his fingers, could be the next vice president of the United States.
You're not going to use the story, Mr. Scott?
No, sir. This is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
Oh, there you go, Chris.
I had no idea you were going to play that clip when I quoted
I didn't
that
either.
Line.
I'm sorry. It's the first time I'm hearing it, too.
I sound very prescient.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's the famous clip at the end, and... Yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable story. Remarkable,
Kenneth
Turan, I want to ask you this. When we think about our favorite films, I mean, those are things we sort of carry with us, right? As you go Absolutely. Through life, you can conjure them up quickly. You can remember. But
You know, this must have been very difficult for you, because I imagine with all the probably thousands of movies that you've seen over the years, since the time you were in a class with Judith Crist all these years later, right? That you probably think of great scenes, great moments in films that yes, you relish seeing that scene again, you savor that one performance, that one moment in a film, but where the film itself does not meet the standard of a film you would want to see over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people it was harder to get the list down to 54 than it was to write the actual book, because I've seen so many films. And I saw every film again before I selected it, to make sure that the whole film held up for me. And it's true, you don't want just some scenes that appeal to you. You want to feel that way about the entire film.
Yeah. You can become fascinated, almost obsessed with a scene in a film, right, Chris? That rises to this greatness when the film itself is not that great.
Yeah, you can certainly, you know, end up becoming, as you said, obsessed with that one moment. Certainly, I would not be able to whittle down to 54. I am curious, Kenneth, why you think you have so many more films from the 1950s, I think you have 12, versus the 1970s, where you have two. I'm just curious how you think that worked out, because both decades offer sort of a rich tapestry of cinema from which to choose.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I wrote, as I say, I wrote this book one film at a time. I didn't make a big list and then write everything. So, and then I didn't break it up into decades till I was finished writing it. And I was as surprised as everyone else is that I had so many films from the 50s and so few films from the 70s. You know, the 50s really has a hold on me. I think it's kind of a transitional decade. It had some of the classical elements that I like, but it was post-war, so people were pushing things and people were dissatisfied. It has that combination of classicism and dissatisfaction that seems to work well for me. And I like a lot of films from the 70s, but they don't have the hold on me that those 50s films do. The only films from the 70s that are there are The Godfather and Chinatown, and, you know, you can't argue with those. The other films, though I love them, they just don't call to me the way the 1950s films do.
Here's another one from 1960s that I'm curious about. 1964, The Gospel According to St. Matthew. Kenneth Turan?
Oh, this is this is exactly what it says. This is The Gospel According to St. Matthew. This is a filmed version of the Gospel, that book of the New Testament. It's made by Pier Paolo Pasolini, who was an unlikely guy to make a religious film. He was a communist. He was a wild and crazy guy, hard liver. But he makes a straight-ahead version of the Gospel, showing Jesus as kind of a socially conscious man. He used a lot of Italian peasants and shot in the wild parts of Italy instead of the Holy Land. But it's this is a film that film critics and the Vatican agree is one of the great religious films. It's just a remarkable story.
Wasn't he accused of blasphemy?
Initially I'm not sure, but, you know, eventually when the Vatican made a list of the great films, they put this film on it.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Chris, are you familiar with it?
I've seen it once. I always kind of, my favorite religious film from the 60s is Andrei Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev, about the great, you know, Russian Orthodox monk. But I would put the two of them in the same category, sort of great religious experiences on film.
We'll move ahead to the 70s now. You did mention already, of course, the Godfather is on your list. And like Casablanca, a lot of people would put the Godfather on the list, and maybe Godfather 2 as well. But Kenneth Turan, I just love to hear a little bit from you about seeing that film again recently. As you were putting this book together.
Oh my God! I mean, it's such a pleasure to see The Godfather again. You know, this is one of those films that it's a classic film where it's like, you know, you're kind of channel surfing and it pops up on the screen.
Oh, yeah.
And say, well, I'm kind of busy, but I'll give it 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't stop watching the thing.
That's right.
It's a great human story. It's really Shakespearean in its characters and its emotions and its tragedies and its suffering and its romance. It's a huge epic. It's got a lot of wonderful actors that were not as big stars when they made the film that became bigger later on. It's just, it's enrapturing.
A couple of interesting emails for you here, Kenneth Turan. One is from Steve in Baltimore. It's a pretty interesting question. Ask if Kenneth Turan thinks young people today may be missing something by being able to watch any movie anytime.
Well, you know, I wish they took advantage of that ability. One of the great frustrations I have is that, you know, when we were younger and we wanted to see these films, it was very difficult. Now it couldn't be easier, and enough people don't take advantage of it. I think people would like these films if they saw them, but they feel that it's not going to be for them, so they don't put the disc on. I wish they would.
Now, I'm interested to hear from Chris Reed on this, too, because, well, your students are film students, video students.
Right, but there's so much, you know, it's almost 120 years now of motion picture history, and mm-hmm. so there's so much to choose from that it's hard for people who aren't initiated into cinema history to make the right choices, and it's thanks to books like Kenneth Turan's that they perhaps have a good guide for choosing some films that a great film critic like Mr. Turan has chosen for them. So I think I see that as the great value of a book like this because there's so much to choose from.
And it all began with the million-dollar movies, the Kenneth Turan in New York City. And here's an email from Gigi in Towson, Maryland, who says, I also grew up outside of New York City and remember million-dollar movies, and in particular, the fact that they played them over and over again so you could watch a movie during a week many, many times. The two I remember watching on our big black-and-white TV were James Cagney in Yankee Doodle Dandy, which you mentioned, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I remember having to hide my 7-year-old eyes looking at the scary makeup of Charles Laughton as the hunchback. Yeah.
Yes, I remember that one as well. I mean, God bless Million Dollar Movie. Really, it helped a lot of people, fall in love with movies.
More to read and in Kenneth Turan's book. We thank you for your time today. It was great to get to speak with you finally after listening to your reviews many years on NPR's Morning Edition. Again,
thank you. This was a pleasure.
Kenneth Turan's book is not to be missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. So thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Kenneth. It was an honor to share airtime with you.
Oh, this was a real treat for me. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And stay there, folks. More of this special edition of Midday on Film. When we come back, Eli Wallach, the prolific and versatile character actor, died yesterday at the age of 98. Wallach's most famous roles were that of a Mexican bandit in the 1960s, The Magnificent Seven, and as Tuco in the Western classic, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. We'll be right back. The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. Eli Wallach, who died yesterday, he was 98 years old. I love this actor. He put the ug in ugly, right, Chris? He's the ugly in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
He's the ugly. He's Tuco, the ugly, as you see in the opening credits when it freeze phrases on him.
Yeah. And I also remember him, of course, from The Magnificent Seven, where he played a similar character.
That's right. He was really good at playing these sort of mustache-twirling villains.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Eli Wallach. First of all, he's described in all the obituaries today as a character actor, and we use that term. I think you know what it means when you say it. Well, he's a character. What does it mean, really?
Well, on its most basic level, it means someone who's not a leading man or leading woman, and usually that means that they don't look like Robert Redford, right? So it's
right.
On the practical movie star level.
Right.
But it also means people who can really disappear into these supporting roles, and they might, play similar supporting roles as Eli Wallach did so frequently, but they're really good at kind of raising the level of an overall film production or theater production just by their presence and by their ability to really kind of take a small role but really, add character to it. And
who would you put in that class today? Who is a character actor? Steve Buscemi? I don't know.
Steve
he just
Buscemi
popped
is
into
an
my,
excellent
mind.
Choice.
Right?
Excellent choice.
Okay.
And one of the interesting things is that in the late 60s, actors who might have had careers as character actors ended up becoming leading men and revolutionizing what we saw as leading men, like Dustin Hoffman. He does not look like Robert Redford, and in fact Robert
right.
Redford was apparently originally considered for that role in The Graduate,
right.
Or at least the character was written as a Robert Redford type. Al Pacino, even Robert De Niro, they do not look like typical Hollywood leading men before
right,
that period.
Right.
So they really helped change how we saw leading leading actors.
So Eli Wallach, whose career spanned so many years, so many decades, would do these roles, take on these roles, and really make them stand out, right?
He would.
And he also did stage. I mean, this was a talented actor.
He was very prolific on the stage. In fact, he did far more stage work than he did screen work. But as he said, he would go off, ride a horse in Spain, and earn enough money that he could then do a couple of good stage shows.
Well, this actually, was this Italy, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly? Is this Sergio Leone?
It's an Italian film, but often the spaghetti westerns were shot in Spain because the desert there looks like the American West.
I'm so glad to have you here to clear that up for me. I don't know where in Italy this was, Sicily, but it was often Spain.
It was often Spain, yeah.
And it was called a spaghetti western because Leone directed them?
And other Italian directors like Franco Neri, who did Django. It just became a genre in the 60s that Italian directors would make these westerns.
Okay, and the music by Ennio Morricone.
Exactly.
Another Italiano. So here's a scene. This is Eli Wallach. Folks will remember The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. This is where he's playing Tuco. Now, in this scene, Chris, he's rebutting his estranged brother, who is chastising him for being a bandit.
I, Tuco Ramirez, brother of Brother Ramirez, will tell you something. You think you're better than I am. Where we came from, if one did not want to die of poverty, one became a priest or a bandit. You chose your way, I chose mine. Mine was harder. You talk of our mother and father. You remember when you left to become a priest, I stayed behind. I must have been 10, 12, I don't remember which, but I stayed. I tried, but it was no good. Now I'm gonna tell you something. You became a priest because you were too much of a coward to do what I do.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah, you can almost hear the mustache twirling. I mean, he's a great actor, but definitely sometimes, you know, a bit of a hammy presence on screen, which is why we love him in the same way we love William Shatner. You know, because that hamminess works so well in those parts.
Does it feel hammy now or back then? I mean, back then, I think it was pretty convincing. I was probably 14.
I think now with some distance. But you know what? He's so wild. You can't take your eyes off
him.
That's
true.
And what's funny is he played these Mexican banditos. He played these Italian mobsters. And he's a Jewish kid from New York who grew up as one of the few Jewish kids in an Italian-American neighborhood. But he ended up having this amazing career playing, you know, a lot of Italian mobsters.
It reminds me of Anthony Quinn in that regard.
Yeah, Anthony Quinn, who I never realized till later was Mexican. I always wondered where he was from because he played everything under the planet.
So can we go to Magnificent Seven next? Now, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was 1966. Back in the Magnificent Seven, 1960, right? Am I right on that? Yeah, 1960, because Yul Brynner. Who else is in Magnificent Seven? Robert Vaughn.
I'm trying to remember the other actors.
All those guys.
It's directed by John Sturges, and it's adapted from Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai.
Right, and he plays again the bandit. This scene is when the bandits return to the village. The village is basically hopeless, and they need some help. And Yul Brynner and the guys have come in to try to save them. Right.
Do you hear that? We're trapped, all 40 of us, by these three, or is it four? They couldn't afford to hire more than that.
We come cheaper by the bunch.
Five? Even five wouldn't give us too much trouble.
There won't be any trouble if you ride on.
Ride on? I'm going into the hills for the winter. Where am I going to get the food for my men?
Buy it or grow it.
Or maybe even work for it.
Seven. Somehow I don't think you've solved my problem.
Solving your problems isn't our line.
We deal in lead, friend.
So do I. We're in the same business, huh?
Only as competitors.
Why not as partners? Suppose I offer you equal shares.
In what?
Everything, to the last grain.
And the people in the village? What about them?
I leave it to you. Can men of our profession worry about things like that? It may even be sacrilegious. If God didn't want them sheared, he would not have made them sheep.
That's such a great line.
It is a great
line. And this film comes only 3 years after his first screen appearance, which was in Baby Doll, directed by Elia Kazan. So, you know, he really had a pretty meteoric rise as a sought-out Hollywood character actor.
that scene, he's trying to make a deal with the good guys, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Who are the other good guys? I can't remember. Our internet is down here. I can't Google it. Was James Coburn in The Magnificent Seven?
I can't remember, but there's a German actor, Horst Buchholz, who's the young guy.
Right. Yeah. And the man from Uncle, Robert Vaughn.
That's right.
But I'm stumped on the rest. I shouldn't have asked. Yeah, but someone in our audience is going to email me the cast of Magnificent Seven because our internet is down right now. Can we get email? Is our email work? Our email's working, but our internet for Googling is down.
And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that same year he appeared in John Huston's The Misfits with Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe.
Now, I was surprised. I forgot about him being in this. And we have a scene from The Misfits. I love this movie. Marilyn Monroe, Clark Gable. Well, I don't know if it's a great movie, but I like it.
And it's Clark Gable's last because he died of a heart attack shortly afterwards.
In this scene, so Eli Wallach plays this guy who's like he's hitting on Marilyn Monroe all the time, right? And he's trying to get her to leave the older guy, Clark Gable, in this scene.
Well, tell me. He doesn't know what you're all about. He'll never know. Tell me, Rosalind. I've been waiting. I'm going out of my mind with waiting. Come back with me. Give me a week, 2 weeks. Let me show you what I am. Tell me, Rosalind. Give me a reason and I'll stop it. There'll be hell to pay, but you give me a reason, I'll do it.
A reason? You, a sensitive fellow. So sad for his wife. Crying to me about the bombs you've dropped and the people you killed. You have to get something to be human. You never felt anything for anybody in your life. All you know is the sad words. You could blow up the world, and all you would feel is sorry for yourself.
Well, he's kind of creepy in this scene.
Yeah, but it's a good role, and it's nice to hear him not putting on, a Mexican accent just for variety. And he gives him an amazing performance in this film. And Montgomery Clift is also in it.
The last clip we have is from only 8 years ago when he was 90?
Yeah.
Am I right? Eli Wallach
He kept on acting right up to the end.
This is a film called The Holiday, and a scene with Kate Winslet. We don't have that clip? Okay. I'm sorry, I thought we had a clip for that.
It's a really sweet film.
That's all right. I don't know anything about it.
It's a really sweet film where he plays an aging screenwriter in Hollywood, and Kate Winslet ends up coming from England to spend time in the home of Cameron Diaz, and she does a switch, Cameron Diaz, and goes to England, and they each find love in their new landscape.
Oh, wait a minute.
Kate Winslet falls in love with Jack Black.
I did see that. Yeah, Eli Wallach is. I remember
he's
that.
He's the old screenwriter.
Yes, old screenwriter in a big mansion. Or
that is correct.
Right?
Yeah. It's a very sweet film. Very sweet film.
He was married to Ann Jackson.
Ann Jackson. They were married in 1948, and she's still alive. She was born in 1926.
Well, I'm glad we got to spend a few minutes talking about Eli Wallach, which a lot of people remember him from these movies that we mentioned today. Great actor. Nice long life. 98 years old.
98 years. You can't complain. Yeah, and he will be missed though.
Christopher Llewellyn Reed, along with Linda DeLibero, joins us once a month for Midday on Film, the first Friday of every month. Are you back in July with us?
Yes, sometimes toward the end of July, actually.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the summer movies.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for being here today and sharing our time with Kenneth Turan and a little appreciation of Eli Wallach. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Dan. Great to be here.
Yeah, and thank you, everybody, for tuning into our show for today. We thank you very much, and we thank Breathe Bookstore Cafe for providing lunch for our guests as well. So have a great afternoon. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.